Whatever town or village you enter, find out who in it is worthy and stay there till you leave. As you enter the house, greet it, and the greeting was Shalom, peace. If the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. Blessed are the peacemakers, as we learned in the Beatitudes. If it's not worthy, let your peace come back to you. And go and find somewhere else. If anyone will not welcome you, and we've already seen Jesus hasn't been welcomed a couple of times by the Pharisees, if anyone doesn't welcome you and doesn't listen to your words, shake the dust from your feet and leave that house or town. That's a very dramatic Jewish practice. Because the Holy Land was holy, a Jew coming in from what we'll now call Jordan or the Transjordanian area, or coming from Syria, or coming from what we'll call Lebanon, or coming up from Egypt, when they crossed into their own country, they wouldn't bring the dust, the polluted dust of a foreign land, into the Holy Land. They'd shake it off and come in into this holy land that belonged to God. They keep it pure. And the way we try and keep bugs out of the country by, what's that gift called? Where you? Oh yeah, I was thinking of fruit coming into the country and you've got to put it into quarantine or something to stop. So they were stopping the evil that's in the soil, in the land. It means a lot to these people. That wouldn't come in and pollute our holy land. Well, likewise, it's saying here, don't let their rejection of you pollute the community of you. If they're not welcoming it, then shake the dust off, clear yourself of all that, and go on. I tell you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. The sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, who knows, there's nothing historical in any of this. This is an old legend from the book of Genesis. But everybody knew that there were terrible seismic problems in this rift valley, starting from underneath Lebanon and going right down to Lake Victoria in Africa. And that's the biggest rift in the earth's crust, so there must have been terrific seismic activity and volcanic activity and so on. And in the long distant memory, that's where that terrific rift in the crust of the earth, you've got the Dead Sea forming, and that was forming over a part that used to be fertile, where there were now towns like Sodom and Gomorrah and Zeboim and a few others whose names I've forgotten. And so that became, in the legendary imagination of people, a symbol of those people must have done something absolutely terrible to be so punished by God. You get that's the mentality of the day. Something terrible happened. Why? Well, the book of Genesis chapter 19 tells us, and it was perfect for that Eastern world. It was the sin of non-hospitality, failure to welcome. It's the story of Lot. It also has sexual connotations, but they're quite secondary in the book of Genesis. And the main thing is they were not hospitable. They didn't welcome the guests properly. And in the East, that's a terrible crime. Hopefully it would be a terrible crime here too. Well, if people don't welcome Jesus and his message, then they will destruct. The destruction that'll mean for them will be awful. Worse than that of Sodom and Gomorrah. And now we have a verse that I've spent a lot of time thinking about and trying to tease out a bit for myself and for you from the internal evidence of Matthew's Gospel. Jesus says, see, verse 16 of chapter 10, I am sending you out like sheep in the midst of wolves. Now, be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. So I want to spend maybe 5-10 minutes with you just on that one verse. How does Matthew understand being wise as serpents and innocent as doves? We'll start with the first one. Innocent in English really means not harming anybody. Notcheo in Latin means to harm, and the I-N in the front is a negative, so not harmful. That's not quite the meaning of the Greek. Akerios means not counterfeit. It means simple. Simple meaning you are what you are. You're not pretending to be something other than you are. And something that's simple is clearly what it is. You know, they talk about the double tongue. Speak with a double tongue means you say one thing and you say something. It's tricky. It's political speak. Is that a word these days? Or news speak, perhaps? It's words that are going to be politically okay but have nothing to do with the truth. And that's a tragic thing to say if that were general of politics. But insofar as it's in politics or in sermons or anywhere else, then it's an awful thing where the truth is not being conveyed. Well, that's what it means. So as a dove, just be simple. Some word simple might even be a better translation. Now, that truth, Paul, I've just given you two texts where Paul says the same thing, just to see that it's obviously a that was picked up from Jesus. Paul in Romans says, I want you to be wise in what's good and guileless in what is evil. It's a bit like it, isn't it? Without guile, as far as evil goes, and wise as far as what is good. In his letter to the Philippians, chapter 2, Paul says, be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a perverse people. Keep yourself clean from the surrounding pollution, corruption, oil slick, somehow fly above it or whatever. So far the word innocent hasn't been used in Matthew, but the word wise has been. When the person who built his house on rock was wise, phronimos, intelligent, thinking, wise. And later on we'll find there are five wise virgins and five foolish ones, and the word will be used again. Let's start. What might Matthew mean by being as innocent as a dove? Well, my suggestions just from Matthew are these. To be pure in heart, we've met already. Blessed are the pure in heart, they will see God in the Beatitudes. So we're being invited again, I think, to be pure in our heart. Also in the Sermon on the Mount, don't resist evil with evil. I think that's also included. Resist evil, yes, but not with evil. Well, if you can resist evil without using evil, again, I think you're picking up something of what it means to be innocent as a dove. Because the cunning in us can sometimes outwit the evil by another evil, and we think we're winning, but we're actually being corrupted. Loving our enemies, a bit the same. Tendency with an enemy is to resist an enemy and become an enemy to them, so that the enemy then corrupts you or me. And Jesus is saying, don't let that happen. Stay who you are. Be simple like a dove, not one thing, not like a serpent sloughing off a skin and putting another one on. Who's really underneath all these skins? Be perfect as your Father is perfect, I think, is another way of which we've looked at already at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, or chapter 5 of it. That is that perfection of love. Staying perfect in love without anything else corrupting the love. Chapter 6, keeping our heart fixed on God, Jesus advised us. Maybe that's another image for being as simple or innocent as a dove. Striving first for the kingdom of God, chapter 6, again. So he's given us a lot already in the discipleship theme that I think we can pick up here again and see them summed up there, and later on, perhaps more beautifully than any of those, when he says, unless you become like a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. And we look into a little child's eyes, they clearly are innocent as a dove. Now, can you as an adult have the same innocence? Some people do. Some people lose it. But please don't forget that reconciliation isn't just forgiving sin. Reconciliation is restoring innocence. It's very important to believe that. I remember telling someone 30 years ago, and I was 30, 25. Oh, help us, it was, anyhow, it was about that time ago, when I was first chaplain at the uni, and a person came to see me who'd been in a pretty unfortunate relationship problem and was sorry, and through the sacrament of reconciliation. I remember telling this woman that that meant that her innocence had been restored. Well, she'd never heard that before. Like, it meant such a lot to her. That, like, innocence is restored, in a sense. Also, there's, you know, I hope you know what I mean by that. But it means something very important, and it meant a lot to her to hear. And I was thinking, why hasn't she been told that ever since she was that high? Because that's what forgiveness is. It restores the innocence. It's forgiveness from the inside. It's not an outside painting over woodwork that hasn't been prepared. It's not a cover. It's an internal healing. So a restore of innocence. We can become like a child again. That's what Jesus said to Nicodemus, and it's true for you and true for me. There's some thoughts about it. What about being wise as a serpent? So it's not just being an innocent in the sense of naive. Some people remain innocent because they don't think. They wander through life and don't notice anything. Everyone's happy. Oh, Hitler, thank you for coming. What a darling. Sit down and have a cup of tea. That's kind of nice. But we might need to have a little bit more astuteness than that. And we might need to have some kind of wisdom to know. Otherwise we can, what do you call that, when two people are in a situation and they are codependent, we can create a relationship that's messy by being codependent with it and therefore reinforcing it. So wisdom's needed. Here's some examples. Jesus recognized hypocrisy. We need to too. What do you do when you recognize is another matter. But to not recognize the mask, the untruth, the hypocrisy is no virtue. Know when we're being led into sin, chapter 5, verse 29. See it for what it is and refuse it and stand firm. Say no. With insight, learn from life experience. Don't get caught up in a mucked up kind of an expectation of other people. Be yourself, and that requires courage, clarity, experience, doesn't it? Maturity. Don't throw your pearls before swine, Jesus said. A tough saying, but the reality is kind of there too. Recognizing false prophets, he says, you'll know them by their fruit. Taste the fruit, and when it tastes lousy, spit it out. Don't keep swallowing it. Verse 17. Beware of them. So, well, Jesus is having a go too. Beware of them. For they'll hand you over to councils and they'll flog you in the synagogues. You'll be dragged before governors and kings because of me. As a testimony to them and the Gentiles. But when they hand you over, so Jesus is suffering. Love is a strange thing. It's not always accepted. Your love hasn't been always accepted. And it hurts when it's not accepted. And it can be misjudged and thrown back at you and all of that. What do you do when that happens? Jesus says, keep loving. He says, when they hand you over, don't worry about how you to speak or what you to say. And he only said that because that's our tendency to worry. He says, for what you are to say will be given you at the time. It's not you who speak. It's the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Trust God who loves you and the Spirit that breathes life into you moment by moment. Don't plan the future too tough.
Just stay who you are. You'll be okay. Terrible stuff. Brother will betray brother to death, father his child. That had already happened in Matthew's community. Children will rise up against parents and have them put to death. We didn't have to wait for the killing fields of Cambodia to see that. Sadly, it can happen in any culture that's oppressed by mental police that don't let kids think or don't let anybody think and lock people into religious or any other mania. Our religion is meant to be an intelligent religion. It's meant to liberate people and it's meant to leave people free to think, surely. And if Christianity is not attractive enough to attract, forget about it. It's not worth a crumpet. Because it is attractive enough to attract. It doesn't need forcing. You'll be hated by all, here it is again, because of me. And now, the main statement of all apocalyptic literature, you'll find this in the book of the Apocalypse, you'll find it in the book of Daniel, you'll find it in all the intertestamental material about what ultimately matters at the final judgment. The one who endures to the end will be saved. Hold on to your love, hold on to Jesus, hold on to what you know to be right and to your faith. Trust in God and just keep going. And don't let even that kind of terrible persecution stop you. Be a missionary. Stop you going out. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. For truly I tell you, you'll not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes.
The coming of the Son of Man, an equivalent statement, is the day of the Lord. And I'll have to do this briefly, but I will do it briefly. In the Old Testament scripture, the day of the Lord had, in a sense, two focal points. One was historical events which indicate God's judgment. They were called a day of the Lord. A victory in battle, for example, would be a day of the Lord when God would show whose side he was on. The birth of a prince would be a day of the Lord. The release of these, in 701 Sennacherib, the release of the siege against Jerusalem was a day of the Lord. On the other hand, destructively, the destruction of Jerusalem was a day of the Lord. In other words, a day when God's will is revealed dramatically in history. That's how they imagined it. They were days of the Lord. But that led to an imaginative flight of language where they talked about the day of the Lord. One day, God's will be revealed for the whole world to see. That's the day of the ultimate judgment of God when evil is crushed and love and truth are vindicated. Now that's beyond history, or the end of the age, all kinds of images they use. You can only use imagery here, we're not talking about tight philosophical concepts. But it's a faith that ultimately truth, light, love will triumph. So the day of the Lord, or the coming of the Son of Man, can mean a number of things. And in Matthew, God's judgment in historical events would be a coming of the Son of Man. Because the Son of Man, I did with you earlier, I want to do it again in the book of Daniel, was the day of the judgment, wasn't it? God opened the books for the judgment and someone came on the clouds like a Son of Man and he was given power and majesty and glory and something. Daniel chapter 7. So this is the destruction of Jerusalem could be a day of the Lord. You will not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. Son of Man coming in judgment at the destruction of Jerusalem is part of the mental world. And Matthew's gospel, probably written after the destruction of Jerusalem, would include that in his ideas. Positively, Jesus' resurrection was a day of the Lord. And that's going to happen before the missionary work is completed. So Matthew may have that in mind as an understanding of Jesus' statement. On the other hand, He may be talking about God's ultimate judgment, the ultimate day of the Lord, the coming of Jesus in glory. And how do I put this briefly? At the time of Jesus, in the Jewish world, where there was a lot of fascination about resurrection of the dead, angels, devils, judgment, what's going to happen in the afterlife, that was a fairly recent idea, and people were exploring it all over the place, and I've got two big volumes in my room of extra non-biblical material about apocalypses and written at the, just before Jesus' time and just after in the Jewish world. So it was an area of great fascination for the thinkers. Part of their thought was the resurrection of the body was intimately connected with the judgment. Like that's the kind of, as soon as people rise from the dead, well then you have the last judgment. That's closely connected in their thinking. Well, when Jesus rose from the dead, everybody, by the look of it, thought, oh, the end's going to come really soon. Evil will be destroyed, good will triumph, the new heaven and the new earth will come, and so on. Evil will be purged from the world because Jesus has risen, so we're just waiting, imminent, expecting the end spoken of in these terms. We know 2,000 years later that's not the case. There isn't a temporal connection between those two. So we have to think of it differently. I read recently, in fact I used it in my sermon on Sunday, if you can bear with it again, St. Bernard in the early 12th century, so what, 900 years ago, or the late 1000s, whichever, the late 1000s or the early 1100s, had this to say when he asked that question. He says, "We know a threefold coming of the Lord. In the first coming, he came in the weakness of human nature. In the intermediate coming, he comes in the power of the Spirit. In the final coming, he will come in the majesty of glory. Therefore, this intermediate coming is, as it were, a way of connecting the first coming to the final coming. In the first coming, Christ was our Redeemer. In the final coming, he will reveal himself as our life. In the present coming, he is our rest and our consolation." So the coming of the Lord encompasses in theology all the ways in which God comes to us in Jesus. Historically, finally in the unimaginable mystery of glory, heaven, and now in our lives, at the moment of our death for each of us, and now in the Eucharist, reconciliation, all the other.